Welcome to part two of our podcast with the Metropolitan Police Department, with Commander Ralph Ennis of the Technical Services Department, Derek Meeks, Director of the Body-Worn Camera Program and Technology Innovation, and Anita Ravishankar, Metropolitan Police Department Research Fellow.
For a background, since we've been talking about this, can you give our listeners a background on the size of MPD, how many officers it has, the area it patrols, and then just briefly an overview of about how many other law enforcement agencies you interact with inside the district?
Yeah, MPD's, we're authorized strength of 4,000. We currently have about 3,750 on the force. The population of the district that we serve is about 670,000 that live here. I've been told it goes upwards of a couple million every day for the people who work and visit the city. We have seven police districts, which are, within our 68 square miles that we have here. What's unique about D.C. compared to other places is that because D.C. is a district, we are the city, the state, the federal. We are all of those policing activities rolled up into one. We don't have state police to do traffic enforcement. We don't have sheriffs to handle our prisoners. So the police department ourselves is a multifaceted department that has to handle tasks that other departments might have a specialty agency that would handle for them. There's 35 other law enforcement agencies that work with us inside the district. They range in size from agencies that merely police a building to agencies like the Capitol Police and United States Secret Service Uniform Division and the Park Police, which were very large agencies. And let me correct myself. I think I gave the wrong size of D.C. D.C. is actually 68 square miles. And then we work closely with these federal, because of the federal presence in D.C. and the fact that we have to protect the president or assist in protecting the president. We have very good relationships with agencies such as the Secret Service, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. I mean, we have a unique little relationship here in the district. So we have our hands full in coordination, but because we do it all the time, we're pretty good at it, and we work very well with our partners here.
One of those things where it speaks to kind of the overall philosophy that Chief Lanier brought to the table, and I think is a department philosophy at large, which is the kind of inclusiveness and considering the holistic perspective, including all of the different law enforcement partners in the conversation and in the ongoing dialogue as the program continues to develop. It's the same kind of thing has happened with community members, the special interest groups, kind of across the board. It's truly a how do we find a solution that makes as much sense to everybody as possible.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to add, because I kind of gave overview to the city, because D.C. is made the way it is that we have a local government, so we have a mayor and a city council, but we're also accountable to the Congress and to all the executive branch agencies in the city, too. So it's quite a labyrinth to navigate every day to make sure that when we're trying to have an initiative, especially something of the magnitude of the body camera program, that we do so engaging all the stakeholders so we have as little resistance as possible.
Well, thank you for that. And that's I wanted to give the listeners a background because of all the intricacies of the different federal and local law enforcement agencies you have to work with and the policy considerations around that and the efforts that you guys have gone through to do that. So I just wanted to commend you on your efforts. You mentioned the uniqueness of your department, and that holds true for the prosecutorial and judicial side, too. So can you talk about that side and the collaboration there and how that affected policy formation also?
Yeah, so we have prosecutors. The Office of Attorney General is responsible for prosecuting low-level adult offenses. And for the sake of explaining my definition of low level, it is disorderly conduct type arrests, traffic arrests for driving while intoxicated, those type of arrests. So the Office of Attorney General prosecutes those, and then all juvenile cases that are not prosecuted as an adult. The Office of Attorney General is a local agency that is accountable to the mayor. Then for all of our adult cases in the serious cases, anything from a shoplifting up to a homicide, they're prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office. And the United States Attorney's Office is accountable to the President and to the Attorney General of the United States. So you can see just from that, we have people's, where they're coming from when they're making decisions to prosecute cases. And even the infrastructure they have within the offices is vastly different depending on where you're sitting. So one of the things we did when we were in the planning process for BWCs, we coordinated with the prosecutors. It's one of the very first things we did. We ensured that we included them prior to finalizing our policy as well, because we wanted to make sure that we weren't infringing upon their ability to prosecute cases from any aspect of our program. So we had meetings with them, and as a result of the meetings, we were able to consider their concerns, and they had some, and as we progressed with our program and implementation, we changed things. So there's certain small policies we changed to make sure that videos were more easily available to them. So we really did consider their feedback. Basically, the major considerations, which I'll talk about a little bit later, I think, but the considerations of recording policies, when you do and do not record, how long you keep the video, your retention, and then the privacy concerns were all coordinated with input from the prosecutors, because all of those issues directly affect them being able to prosecute their case through the entire judicial process. The other thing you have to consider, and this is a biggie, especially when you're in a smaller county or, a more complex area where you have elected state attorneys and things like that, is you have to consider the ability of the prosecutor to be able to get the video that they need. So we ensured they had easy access to the video and that we helped them train the prosecutors on accessing the video. So we ended up going with a vendor solution, which was a cloud-based solution, which allowed the U.S. Attorney and the Office of Attorney General direct access into the system themselves. And we made the determination early on that we weren't going to be the controller of the video, in other words, that we were going to allow them to have open and unfettered access into our system to pull video whenever they need it. That's also something that I understand is being debated around the country as, agencies are deciding to implement a program or not, but we're proud of our department. We're proud of, our officers' work. So we figured that there was no problem for them having open access, and it made life easier on us because then we weren't having to transport video back and forth or having somebody dedicated to sharing video with them. The system allows them immediate access. We don't have to rely on DVDs anymore. And so far, we've received pretty good positive feedback from the prosecutors. And like I said, we've used our lessons learned and made changes as we needed to. One thing I do want to point out, though, is that, I don't think we have 2 days to maintain this discussion, so we can't go too deep into it, though, is that body camera video changes the dynamics of prosecutions. And, certain things that before were having to be explained through word of mouth on the stand now are in front of you on video, and so they had to look at how they were actually approaching their prosecutions and, through their different motions hearings and things like that. So it gave them a whole new list of issues that they had to address when they were, taking the cases to court, or even deciding whether they were going to take a case to court or not.
Another aspect of engaging with them, the prosecutors, and it's actually something that's true internally as well, the sheer volume of information is extraordinary. And so that's been something that while we all anticipated, the magnitude, I think, was even more special, if you will. And it's something that we're looking forward to finding, increasing technology ways to cope with that. But we're still in a position where it is a challenge just to the overall volume.
Yeah, they have a lot of considerations. I'll just leave it at this. But when you're thinking about Jinx and Brady material and things like that, when you have 20 videos from one crime scene, it leaves the prosecutors in a precarious situation to have someone to be able to review that video to make sure that they're disclosing everything that needs to be disclosed in their hearings in court.
And this is as a slightly lighthearted moment. Talking with some of the prosecutors, my understanding is the popcorn sales have gone up dramatically because of the volume of video that they have to watch.
Right, yeah. Working with BJ and our BWC TTA provider, some of the biggest questions we get are around, one, storage, and then analytics and redaction, ways to speed that up. And then on the policy side, on whether an officer has a right to review a video before making a statement, especially in use of cases, use of force cases, and then freedom of information and releasing videos have been the two big policy ones that have come up over and over, as I'm sure you guys have seen across the nation. And so those are the topics we're getting, so I appreciate addressing some of those in your remarks so far.
The reality is that the answers to those questions vary so widely depending on where you are in the country, what the climate is in the country politically, and those type of things. But at the end of the day, the biggest, in my opinion, the biggest hurdle for a body camera program is making sure that you're protecting people's rights, rights to privacy, and that you're not, because it's the very first time police are entering people's houses with cameras on in their personal space. So before you decide that you're going to go have a program or you're going to roll out a program, you need to think through all of those issues and make sure that you're not putting yourself, your city, your department in a position to not have the adequate protections in place and then being forced to turn things over that ultimately should not be.
But along those lines, that's another point of pride for me personally with regard to the department. I believe we're one of the first large departments who actually has a dedicated privacy officer. And her responsibility is to understand those kinds of concerns and make sure that we have a very clear balance between achieving the police mission versus balancing individual privacy rights.
Those are both great points, and I think that's exactly why BJ encourages agencies to do collaboration with law enforcement, the community partners, and the prosecutors to come to a decision that works best for their community around these topics. I wanted to move on because I know we have Anita on here and we haven't heard from her yet. And so could you guys all tell us about your you mentioned research earlier that had been conducted so far. So can you talk about that and then the current state of the research that's going on and what you hope to learn?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just talk a little bit about kind of how this research partnership came to be and then talk a little bit about how we integrated the study kind of directly into the deployment process and what exactly we're looking at. So MPD is partnered with the lab at DC, which is a new scientific team that's housed right within the city government in the Office of the City Administrator. And it's actually the first city level initiative working to really integrate kind of a scientific method into day-to-day governance across all policy areas. So the lab has about 10 or 15 experts in social, behavioral, and data sciences, and also a network of universities and research centers that kind of creates this incredible research resource for our district government and the public. So the lab is basically, the goal here is to provide timely, relevant, and scientifically rigorous evidence to inform the district's most kind of important debates and decision-making processes. And of course, body-worn cameras is right up there on that list. And so we worked with the lab to apply for some grant funding to hire an in-house research fellow, which would be me. And we also have fellow research partners at Yale, Columbia, and the University of Arizona Law School that have all helped kind of design the study and will also support the analysis of the results. So as Commander Ennis mentioned earlier, we integrated this research piece right at the outset of the program. And so we are actually running a randomized controlled trial, and we integrated the randomization right into the deployment process. And doing this and kind of timing it out this way kept our marginal cost of conducting a study relatively low. And I think our study is actually one of the bigger ones in the country. We have about 2,200 officers participating, about 50% in the treatment group with the cameras, and 50% in control group without cameras, of course. And in terms of the kind of questions we're looking at, use of force and civilian complaints are, of course, right up there. And with use of force, I think one thing that's a little bit unique to our study is we disaggregate between looking at just all uses of force as well as kind of serious uses of force, which are defined in our policy. And one of the reasons for this is we think, you know, the cameras might help, with the cameras we might see a decline in serious uses of force, but we might actually see an uptick in the more minor uses of force as officers might be more inclined to just report them because the camera has now captured that interaction. So that's one of the kind of unique things about our use of force research. Civilian complaints is another piece, and then we're also looking at outcomes around policing activity. So how does the camera affect officer discretion around arrests like disorderly conduct, simple assault, traffic? We're also looking at the effects of the cameras on officer discretion in domestic violence cases. DC, of course, has a mandatory arrest policy around domestic violence, so we want to see if the cameras are affecting officer behavior along those lines. And then finally, we are taking a preliminary look at the evidentiary value of the cameras and judicial outcomes. So are prosecutors prosecuting more of those cases? And then if they are, what's going on there? You know, we see more cases go to trial, more guilty verdicts, more pleas, things along those lines. So we have our cameras are out in the field right now. Our study is wrapping up in December. And once our data comes in, the research team is going to be excited to dive into that and take a look at what the cameras have meant for the District of Columbia.
So we're proud of our study here because of the fact that I'm told it's very robust because of the method we use to conduct it. Nita, can you explain the difference between this and some of the other studies that have been done?
Yeah, so some of the other work to date, I believe, has tended to take a before and after approach or where they look at kind of the statistics around use of force, complaints, et cetera, before cameras were deployed and then compare those numbers to the same categories after the cameras are deployed. And one thing that's kind of difficult around that is obviously other things change over time that can affect those same things, use of force, civilian complaints, et cetera, big national events, things along those lines. Whereas with our kind of randomized control trial approach, because we're randomly assigning folks to the to where cameras are not, the two groups are effectively exactly the same but for the camera. And because we're also evaluating them over the same kind of period of time, both groups are subject to the same external factors, whatever they may be, changes in MPD policy, other national events, et cetera. And so we're really able to zone in on the effect of a camera as the causal effect for any changes we see in use of force or complaints or what have you.
This concludes part two of our podcast with the Metropolitan Police Department.